how could liberalism offer what you call a local solidarity? So instead of having these strides towards a universal abstract justice, what would it mean for solidarity to be something that we experience in American neighborhoods?
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 12 of Damn the Absolute. While some philosophers view their primary task as one of discovering the nature of reality and then describing it accurately for the rest of us, others have practiced philosophy as an edifying enterprise, asserting that it should be employed to help us better resolve social and political problems, to change the world. Although both of these approaches have been utilized throughout history, the philosopher John McCumber argues that this later movement in philosophy was mostly purged from academia in the United States starting during the Cold War. 1950s McCarthyism and the Red Scare made many American politicians and professors wary of becoming blacklisted or punished for expressing viewpoints associated with communism. These views included concerns for the poor and economically disadvantaged, support for labor unions, and outcries regarding exploitative economic practices. In turn, this meant that many academics were pushed out of their positions at colleges and universities if they engaged in rhetoric or activities that were perceived as being too red. This academic McCarthyism, according to McCumber, further enabled the ascent of analytic philosophy, a method that attempts to describe the world in the most linguistically precise way possible, leaning heavily toward a mathematical-like language to capture an accurate picture of reality. As a result, philosophy departments throughout the United States became less interested in engaging in edifying philosophy. Consequently, academic McCarthyism helped elevate subjects like mathematics, philosophy of science, and logic at the expense of political and social philosophy. In the latter part of the 20th century, Richard Rorty ushered in a new era of philosophy. Turning their own methods against them, Rorty argued that we ought to jettison analytic philosophy, instead focusing on the practical consequences of our ideas as they manifest in politics and society. Rejecting a representationalist approach, Rorty spent much of his career rallying professors around a more edifying position, suggesting that we're better served by focusing on how ideas can advance society and improve social conditions for people, especially the poor and marginalized. In fact, Rorty went so far as to make several political predictions regarding the practical uses of philosophy and literature in the 21st century. On numerous occasions, he outlined how they would be applied throughout society to transform politics following what he imagines will be the darkest years in American history, from 2014 to 2044. Jacob Goodson is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Southwestern College in Winfield, Kansas. He believes that, despite some of Rorty's philosophical shortcomings, we ought to embrace a more edifying orientation toward ideas. In his recent book, The Dark Years, Philosophy, Politics, and the Problem of Predictions, Goodson considers Rorty's political predictions and how they might help guide us toward a better future. He examines which predictions have already been realized, including the election of a strong man in 2016, which ones might be coming to fruition now, and whether Rorty's conception of an idealized future will unfold in the way that the neopragmatist philosopher hopes it will. A few questions to ponder. In what ways might analytic philosophy be inadequate for addressing social and political problems? Should philosophers focus on changing society, or is their primary role to help us better understand the nature of reality? What does philosophy stand to lose by following Richard Rorty into his neopragmatist vision for the discipline? And where should we place our hope for the future? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We have a ritual here at Damn the Absolute. What is a viewpoint you've held as an adult you were confident would not change that has actually shifted dramatically?
That's a great question. Yeah, so I, as a graduate student in my 20s, I was completely sold on Aristotle's virtue theory, like from beginning to end. Thought he had it all figured out. Thought that my job in life was simply going to be to apply sort of his logic and language to different areas of life that people either wanted me to teach about or write about. And then I hit my 30s, and I think just real life really pushed back on that. First of all, not one single thinker has everything figured out, but also in order to be graceful to myself and to my family members and to my friends, that sort of always trying to judge their character was not going to be the most healthy way to be around other people. And again, towards myself, to really challenge showing grace to myself. And if I made a mistake, to think, oh goodness, that's not just a single mistake, but that's a huge sign about my character. That's so slowly I've moved away from being an Aristotelian in a moral sense and something more kind of modern or maybe even Kantian / Nietzschean in some weird Wardian way, probably. So that would be what I would say.
At the end there, you made a reference to Rorty. Today we're going to be talking about the philosopher Richard Rorty. Who is Richard Rorty?
Who is Richard Rorty? Well, Richard Rorty was an American philosopher, probably the most important American philosopher at the end of the 20th century. He was raised by his mother and father. He was their only child. His father was James Rorty, a journalist. His mother was Winifred Rauschenbusch, the daughter of the social gospel theologian Walter Rauschenbusch. Both Winifred and James called themselves atheists. In their 20s, they were communists. And then because of the treatment of Trotsky in Russia, they decided that they were no longer communists, but something more along the lines of socialist. Right, if they were around today, they would be Bernie Bros. and so this was the environment Richard was raised in, sort of a very socially active family. He received a lot of attention from his mother, and he started college at the University of Chicago at 14 years old. So he left New York for Chicago at 14. He ended up doing 2 degrees at Chicago, bachelor's and a master's degree, both in philosophy, and then went on to Yale to do a PhD in philosophy. He thought he was going to be a metaphysician. He wrote his dissertation on Alfred North Whitehead's process metaphysics, and he thought his job at that point was to bridge analytic philosophy with process metaphysics. And he quickly sort of went down a path, especially once he got to Princeton University as professor. He started seeing both the problems of analytic philosophy as a method, but also the problems of being a constructive, systematic metaphysician. And so that skepticism ended in his most famous publication, which is Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, 1978. Started quite the controversy within philosophy departments in the United States. He ended up going to University of Virginia as a sort of sign that he was no longer part of the Philosophy Guild. He joined the Comparative Lit Department at UVA and really, really stayed in that world in terms of his academic appointments for the rest of his career, both UVA and Stanford, but was still very active within the philosophy community. I think every time that I saw him was either in a philosophy conference or a philosophy panel or a religious studies conference. So very much stayed into the community of philosophy, even though he wasn't being paid by philosophy. And one of his biographers says that was an important part of his identity, was that he wasn't relying on philosophy departments, but still could be part of that community. He died in 2007, and there's a lot of great obituaries about him. He's someone that really did change American philosophy in substantial ways, in ways that I can't even imagine what that would look like today for someone to completely revolutionize an academic discipline. Rorty did that. He achieved that. But he also made some mistakes, which I try to point out in this book. In some ways, he didn't go far enough on political issues or other questions. His most famous student, of course, a PhD student, was Cornel West, who worked with Rorty at Princeton. West has gone on to make a name for himself, obviously, but has also written very honorably and respectfully towards his teacher, Richard Rorty.
For those who are less initiated, Jacob, what is analytic philosophy and why is Rorty so critical of it?
Yeah. Well, analytic philosophy is a style or a method of doing philosophy where you really try to make philosophy look more like mathematics. You try to make philosophy look more like there's a structured way to do analysis, usually analysis of arguments or claims, but that structure looks more like mathematics than it does like what Plato would do, which Plato wrote in dialogue form. And an analytic philosopher would never write in dialogue form. That's too sloppy. There's too much vagueness there. And so what analytic philosophy did in Britain and the United States was try to show that philosophy had as much clarity and precision as mathematics does as a discipline. And so the result was that very important philosophical topics like ethics and political philosophy and social theory sort of dropped off the map in some ways. And we can talk about other reasons for that later that I outline in the book. But part of it is just it's hard to talk about politics in a mathematical mindset and framework. You just don't get the kind of clarity that analytic philosophers expected. And so it's mostly a method and a style. One thing Wardy figured out, and this is the heart of his 78 publication, Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature, is that you could turn analytic philosophy sort of on itself. And so what he did in that book was he writes as an analytic philosopher in that book for sure. He writes with clarity, precision. But he says that there are some underlying assumptions that analytic philosophers have made, particularly in England and the United States, that they have not clarified. And that the big one for him is this notion of mental representation, that everything that's in our head is some sort of clear, distinct object that has its, that represents an object in the world. And Wardy thought that should be argued for if that's the right position. It shouldn't be assumed. And he went through and showed basically from the 1600s on to his own colleagues that position had not been argued for, but just asserted over and over again. And so he used analytic philosophy, the method and the style, as a weapon against analytic philosophy to say, hey, these people say that they've reached clarity and precision on these matters of the world, but they can't even defend a fundamental assumption or presupposition that they make about what's happening in the mind. And so in some ways, he challenged analytic philosophy right where it hurts because he was using their own methods. And what he ended up doing was in the end of the book, which was a very radical argument at the time, was he said, let's just dump all of what we do. Philosophy is not about clarity. It's not about the sort of analytic purity. Philosophy should be simply about edification, right? And what he meant by that word was it should help us live better lives, right? It should be more edifying and it should lead us to better consequences for our lives and for our thinking. And of course, once he made that move, he was clearly a pragmatist because of the emphasis on ideas having particular kind of consequences.
Rorty is a very political thinker, and we're going to be talking about some political predictions that he makes. And you talk about this from a lot of different angles. You talk about in the lead up to talking about his predictions, you argue that the ascension of analytic philosophy was in part a result of academic McCarthyism. What's the story there?
Yeah, so that's something I did not know at all when starting the research for this book. So I had known about the problems and limitations of analytic philosophy, but when I started writing this book, I found that there were actual political and social reasons for why philosophy departments in the States, so this doesn't involve England, but why in the States that they did make a move to make analytic philosophy a monopoly. And this was a kind of way to keep philosophy departments safe. So what happened in the 1950s is a kind of McCarthyism arose within the academy. Now, I want to be clear, and I hope I'm clear in the book about this. Joseph McCarthy did not care at all about professors. So I'm not saying that he was going after professors, but his minions, people that were doing sort of his dirty work, did go after professors in all disciplines. But one of the results of that was that philosophy departments made this deliberate choice to protect themselves, to completely shy away from teaching ethics and political philosophy and social thought. They kicked or excommunicated, maybe a better word, certain thinkers out of the Western canon that they've always taught. Hegel and Marx being the two most obvious ones because of Hegel's and Marx's influences on Soviet communism. But basically, there was a kind of purge, and philosophy departments wanted to protect themselves from being shut down as a department and from having their faculty purge. So departments really went very heavy philosophy of science, very heavy logic and symbolic logic, mathematical logic, all the things that were politically and socially safe, since they don't actually make any challenge on things like capitalism or race questions after the Great Depression and et cetera. And so just for an instance, so people don't think I'm making this up, there was an actual piece of legislation in Michigan that it didn't pass, but this shows you the intensity, that was only going to allow schools like University of Michigan and Michigan State to only teach logic, symbolic logic, and philosophy of science in their philosophy departments. So that's how intense and serious it got. This was a move made by philosophy departments to be more analytic, but also a move made by certain legislators and people outside the academy to make sure that we weren't, or that philosophers weren't teaching their children about Marx or Hegel, because Hegel's so scary. you can't make sense of a sentence, but he's still scary.
How much do you think the climate in academia has changed in regards to the elevation of social and political philosophy as to where it was half a century ago?
That's a great question. I'm of two minds about this. I think that on the one hand, we clearly have moved to a political and social emphasis within philosophy. I mean, it's a department is considered a joke if they don't have at least like three ethicists on staff and offer lots of political and social philosophy. On the other hand, I would guarantee you that if you did a PhD and focused on Karl Marx as a philosopher, you would still not get a job in the US. And so we have made strides in one way, in the more general way of being able to make philosophy more relevant to public life and critical about politics and different aspects of social life. We have achieved that. We still haven't gotten over, though, all of academic McCarthyism. We're still afraid of certain figures in the canon. And that, I mean, that can be completely a career kill if you wrote a dissertation on Marx's Critique of Hegel, for instance, which has nothing to do with communism, but just the name still is scary. And so, and of course, people like, or outlets like Breitbart are still trying to create this scare by saying, if you send your child to college, they're going to study under Marxist philosophers. Well, that's just false. Like, there are no Marxist philosophers, because you couldn't get a job if you're a Marxist. If you're a Marxist philosopher, so yes, I would say I have one hand clapping at the Philosophical Academy. We have done better in terms of really pushing political philosophy and ethics. And I would say most departments, that's what you're going to get most of now, more than logic and philosophy of science. But we still have this kind of excommunication method of certain thinkers in the canon.
On a related note, the story of academic McCarthyism suggests that concern for the poor and the economically disadvantaged is no longer safe. Do you feel like that's shifting as well? There may not be a numerous amount of Marxist professors teaching, but do you feel like academics are more concerned about economically disadvantaged people than they have been?
I think that's a great question. And I want to be both charitable and honest and truthful. I still don't think we're doing enough. I mean, I do think that there certainly are more professors who are thinking out loud about poverty and the lower classes and teaching helpful material. I know at my own college, which is very small, we have a class just called class where they spend a lot of time looking at what it's actually looks, you know, what it actually means to live in poverty. But I say within philosophy, we're still far behind. And I think that, I think part of why I wrote The Dark Years is because the things that Wardy predicted that was going on in the 80s and 90s in the academy, we haven't completely fixed all that. And I think that that's part of why that's Wardy's explanation for Trump's election. And I would say we still haven't fixed really thinking about or helping our students think about the poor. I'm always reminded of Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay on self-reliance, where he talks about, don't obligate me to take care of the poor until they're my poor. That's usually read as Emerson saying people need to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. That's not at all what he's saying in that essay. He's saying what we need is we need citizens of this country to take ownership of the people they care for. We don't need to obligate them to care for people. They need to take ownership. And so for me, that's the direction philosophy should go, is not obligating our students to think about or care for the poor, but to create a kind of intellectual environment where they can take ownership. Like, they have the desire themselves to want to be with people that are different from them, whether that's an issue of economic difference or racial difference or different country. And for me, that's that Emersonian challenge is still with us as philosophers today to teach in a way where our teaching invites people, invites our students, or invites our readers even to really want to care about the poor, want to care about those who are unemployed, and not try to solve the problem systematically because we can't do that as individuals, but to really think about that life is harder in this country if you are not making a living wage, and to think about what that means in terms of your assumptions about such people. So we can do better. I still think Emerson's challenge has not been fully addressed in my mind.
Yeah, I personally appreciate the push from someone like Rorty to get philosophers out of our armchairs or ivory towers and into the streets and into our communities doing concrete things, which there's definitely philosophers who do that, but as you said, not enough.
Yeah, totally agree. That's great. Yeah.
Richard Rorty makes several political predictions about what will happen throughout the 21st century. A lot of these became much more well known with the 2016 election of Donald Trump, which we've actually talked about in a previous episode on Damn the Absolute, so everyone should check that out. Which of Rorty's predictions have become realized so far?
That's a great question. So I think there's two for sure, and then there's a third one that we still might see. So the 2016 election, I think, is obvious. I do think Trump is a strong man. Right? Your listeners who have not read Rorty's Achieving Our Country or my book should know he doesn't name Trump, but he names a strong man who has characteristics such as being openly sexist, being openly xenophobic, so being openly anti-immigration. I mean, Rorty suggests racism. He doesn't say it's going to be explicit or anything, but so all these characteristics of Trump, but he calls this person a strong man. And I do think that Trump is a strong man in the kind of populist sense of saying everyone else has created this problem for you, and now I'm going to be your savior, strong man. So Trump is a kind of weak version of Nietzsche's Zarathustra, I think, where you create the environment that you need saving from, right? I mean, Trump is capitalist oligarch. He is part of the problem, even though he says he's not. And then you claim to your loyal followers that you are the savior. And so in that sense, I do think that Rorty made a prediction about Trump's election, and he may have even had Trump in mind. I mean, Trump had already given interviews in the 80s and 90s that he was aspiring to be a presidential candidate. I mean, I can't imagine that someone like Rorty thought well of someone like Donald Trump in the 80s and 90s. But yeah, I mean, Rorty calls. He calls it on anti-immigration. He calls it on the open sexism language. He calls it on racism. And those are the main attributes that he says the person that we will elect in 2016 will have these characteristics. They'll run on this platform. So that's the first one. The second one, I didn't want to think was true, but after I did my research, Rorty's prediction of gun violence, he says that we'll average a mass murder a day starting in 2014. And so when I started writing this book, I thought, well, that's going to be an easy one to knock down. I'm going to be able to go to some website and find that we only average 5 mass killings a year. But that was not what I found. So Stanford University has done the most work on keeping track of the proliferation of guns and what that has meant for actual killings, murders, and mass murders. And we were averaging over 300 mass killings a year when I wrote this book. So that was 2017. So it's not quite a year. It's not quite a mass killing a day yet, but it's way closer than I ever thought it would be. And I have two daughters. They're both teenagers. It's those details that made this book really hard to write, was just thinking about, there's some parts of the darkness that aren't so scary that Rorty predicts. That part of the darkness is absolutely terrifying. It's horrifying to think that we are, as a country, that we are on the brink of actually averaging a mass killing a day. And maybe we are at this point. I haven't checked the stats since the book's been published, but it was over 300 per year back in 2017, according to Stanford. So those are two that I think we can say that he called. The third prediction that he hasn't got true yet, but he still could, is he predicted that we'd have another Great Depression. His prediction was that it would be worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s. I didn't think that was a possibility when I was writing the book, but then when the pandemic hit in March 2020 and I started seeing businesses close and President Trump started talking about how we can't let the let the virus shut us down or lead us into a recession, I started thinking, well, maybe this is it. Maybe we already has called a third a third thing. But it still looks like we're not, it looks like we're fine. It looks like we're going to be at least not in a depression, right? Some economists do say that we're in a slight recession because of the pandemic. So I don't know if he's going to get that right or not. I do think whether we're in a, find ourselves in a depression or not, we still have to address, right? What we've been talking about over and over, we still have to address economic inequality in this country. I mean, it's whether we're in a recession or depression, there are still people that are hurting financially. And it seems like no matter who's in power, what I'm about to say may piss off some of your left-leaning listeners, but it seems like no matter who's in power, Democrats or Republicans, we just, no one really cares about the poorest of the poor in this country. And so in that sense, I'm not saying Wardy's right about the Great Depression, but I am saying that Wardy's right that if we do not address economic inequality, that we're going to see, we're not going to get out of the dark years. Part of getting out of the dark years means that there's going to be more economic equality than we have now.
This piece about inequality is pretty connected centrally to Rorty's predictions. You mention and draw upon the work of Plato and his own cycles in regards to different forms of government. What are those few forms of government that Plato talks about that we cycle through, and where might the United States find itself right now in that cycle?
Oh, that's a great question. That's every philosopher's dream question for a podcast. Thank you. So in The Republic, Plato outlines five different forms of government. And his main point is that what we see throughout history, political history, is that we go in this particular order. So it's what we call a kind of political or historical determinism that Plato is defending as his position. So what Plato's ideal politics are is aristocracy. Partly because he was an aristocrat himself, and he thought that if people like him were in control, that things would be better. And aristocracy is basically just the belief that justice and power belong to an educated political elite. And so you need people who are educated and virtuous to be your political leaders. And that's going to be sort of the ideal state in this world that we're going to achieve is through an aristocracy. Plato thought that over time, people would get bored with being ruled by those who were educated and virtuous, and that they would look elsewhere. He thought that the next place they would look would be to someone who was heroic or was known for their glory. And so he called this a timocracy, T-I-M-O-C-R-A-C-Y, timocracy. And this is thinking that politics should involve the pursuit of honor, not the pursuit of justice or wisdom. So this is someone who probably in our time would be like a celebrated war general becoming president. Even maybe a top athlete, I've seen people on Twitter ask LeBron James to run for president. That'd be a kind of
democracy.
Might
also include another potential celebrity. I don't want to throw The Rock under the bus, but I wonder if he might be someone who fits in this category as well.
Yeah, to the extent that his acting career has been more like an athlete's life than a movie star. Yeah, I think that's right. And then Plato thought, and this is actually, I think, still a pretty good insight, that while this group of people are getting their honor and fame and glory, that the wealthy would be able to sort of secretly move in and take power. And so he thought we would go from a democracy to an oligarchy. And an oligarchy is a politics that involves the pursuit of wealth and allowing or encouraging the wealthy to increase their wealth. And so the oligarchy is still about protecting the wealth of everyone. It's not about just the person in power's self-interest, but it is about the top class. And this class is probably educated, according to Plato, but they're not virtuous, right? And so that's how they differ from the aristocracy, is they are educated but not virtuous. And then Plato thought that the natural sort of next step is democracy, for which Plato was not a fan of democracy at all. And the reason for this is that eventually, and here this is going to sound like Marx, right? Marx actually borrows this from Plato. Plato envisioned that when the poor are sort of fed up, when the lower classes are fed up, they're going to make a push for power, and that's going to lead to democracy. And even in ancient Greece, that does mean equality for all citizens, no matter the level of education, no matter the level of wealth, no matter the level of virtue. And then Plato imagined that out of that sort of complete distribution of power, which Plato just thought would be pure chaos, out of that chaos, there would rise up one individual that sort of convinced everyone that he was their representative. And so we'd go from a democracy to a tyranny because we'd have a tyrant. And what we would have, what happens with a tyranny is the taking away of equality and freedom that's earned with a democracy. Tyranny occurs when one person rises to power by championing the uneducated against the political elite. And then we would cycle back around to aristocracy. So as I was writing this book, I was at a conference, and Jeffrey Stout, who some of your listeners may know or read, another great professor at Princeton, he did argue that we were seeing this Platonic shift with Trump from democracy to tyranny. So there is that position out there. My claim in the book is that Plato's sort of cycle is helpful, but it's not. We don't live in a deterministic world, right? And so I do think what we saw with Trump was a shift from democracy to oligarchy. And Trump does protect his own self-interest. We all know that. But I do think for the relationship with Putin, which I can't wait for 20 years from now to really read a book about what that was all about. But I do think that that kind of relationship signals that he's not a tyrant per se, but he recognizes himself as part of this oligarchical class that he's trying to protect the wealthiest of the wealthy. And of course, you see this with his friendships with people like Jeffrey Epstein. And I do think there's this oligarchical class that's basically ruling the world right now, whether we want to admit it or not. And I think Democratic people who are Democrats in political office, I think are also, some of them are also part of this or see themselves as part of this class. And that, for me, that's why we're going to continue to have sort of extreme economic inequality. But I disagree with Plato's cycle. And I do think the best judgment to make right now is that we are in a type of global oligarchy. One of my favorite paragraphs of The Dark Years is when I argue that Trump is in fact not anti-internationalist. He's not anti-globalist. He's very much pro-international super rich. And it's not about America first. It's about the wealthy first and the wealthy all over the world first. And I still believe that. And I think the Republican Party, to the extent that they're following Trump, are basically saying, yeah, our job is to protect the wealthiest of the wealthy in this country and in other countries.
In 2014 is a year that Rorty kicks off as the beginning of the dark years. Yes. It's a 30-year span.
Yes.
What exactly, presuming we find ourselves in the actual dark years, what is in store for us, according to Rorty?
So by 2020, so by last year, we should have already started the Great Depression, as I mentioned earlier. Through the 2020s up until the mid-2030s, Rorty envisions a kind of unofficial civil war. He thinks that white suburbanites will basically just start shooting and attacking immigrants and African Americans and other people, groups that they find to be a threat to their own safety and security. And Rorty, it seems like he thinks we don't have a police force that polices that. The only thing that keeps America from just not collapsing is he envisions that the military actually becomes a kind of domestic police force. And so the military is able to keep things at a tolerable level of existence. But basically, a Great Depression, to answer your question clearly, a Great Depression, a civil war that's white suburbia versus the rest of us, and our military is the only thing that's keeping any sense of order. So they're not fighting wars, it seems like Rorty thinks, but they're basically just trying to put fires out. My guess is mostly in the suburbs that he's thinking of. He doesn't mention anything about climate change, which I wanted to add a chapter just on that. But since Rorty didn't mention it, my editor thought that I should stick to Rorty's own predictions. But you could throw that in for the dark years, that if we, there are some scientists that say 2027 is going to be a sort of a tipping point. If we don't make certain changes by then, we are going to start to see really, really negative effects of global warming in our daily lives. Some people would say, especially if you're in Texas, that last week was an instance of the dark years caused by climate change. I'm not sure if that's completely right or not. But in terms of your question, right, Great Depression, a kind of civil war, and then the military having to police U.S. citizens.
It seems also that during the dark years, wealth inequality will continue to rise. What does Rorty think will happen with the wealthy and global elites during this time?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly thinks that's one of the causes of the Great Depression that he predicts. I mean, they will continue to get wealthy. There will be no check on them at all, either at a national scale and for the states or at a global scale. They will simply sort of they can do whatever they want until 2035, it looks like, for Rorty. There's simply no check. He gave this interview that's published as Against Bosses, Against Oligarchs. It's a weird interview, I will admit. But in that interview, he says a bit more, and he thinks that part of what happens because of what I call academic McCarthyism, he doesn't call it that, but he does say because of the restrictions put on what could be taught in the 60s and 70s, he thinks that that set the conditions for 70 or 80 years, that the wealthy will simply be able just to get away with whatever they want to do, because we basically haven't educated three or four generations now to be sort of skeptical of the wealthy, or to put it more charitably, to keep the wealthy accountable, right? Just to have some sort of moral account for what they do. Wardy thinks that in that interview, he says that they'll be able to get away with whatever they want for, he doesn't specify a year, but we could add at least until 2035.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Presuming we are in the dark years or heading into them, Rorty does also give us some hope, which you actually draw into question, but we'll get to that in a moment, that there is life after the dark years. What enables us, in Rorty's mind, what enables us to put that political period behind us? What helps us to transform society after the dark years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I realize that I've been saying the wrong year this whole time, so I'm going to correct myself now. It's 2045. I've been saying 2035. It's because I had the 30-year marker in my head. So it's 2045. So listeners can make that correction for themselves. So around 2045, two things will happen. Two primary things. The first thing, which he doesn't spend much time on, is that there'll be a kind of new Democratic Party that actually comes into power. They will sort of take things over and will make the necessary changes to get out of the Depression, to shut down the unofficial Civil War, all those things. What he seems more interested in is this kind of social transformation. He thinks that in the mid-2040s, he doesn't say where this is going to stem from, but most American citizens are going to start reading lots of novels and start reading scripture, at least the New Testament, it seems like. And that's going to have a moral transformation, is a wave across the land. And the way that he talks about that transformation is, so in the dark years, we all Americans feel shame, and we turn that shame into fear, and we elect people based on our fear. And that's certainly what happened in 2016, I think. In 2040s, we will, because of this reading, because we're just reading a lot more, we will still feel shame, but we will turn that shame into sympathy. And what Wardy argues is that we will start thinking of strangers as neighbors, and we'll start thinking of neighbors as someone who sort of shares a concrete life with us. And so then that will carry us all the way into 2095. So he has a prediction from 2045 to 2095. That's kind of Wardy's social ideal. Wardy, he gave this interview to a German newspaper where he talks more about what this ideal looks like. And he says there's going to be a kind of global free market that is going to equalize everything for everyone. America will not be a leading power, but America will also be sort of a model for how this market can work for the good. And because of all these comments, I critique Wardy quite heavily that basically his vision of 2045, 2095 is just a kind of ideal neoliberalism. So, I mean, I think we've been in neoliberalism for a while. I would agree with Wardy that it hasn't been sufficient. It's not enough. It hasn't been good. But his emphasis on a kind of global free market system seems to me that it's just a repeat of sort of the ideals that you hear about what neoliberalism can achieve economically and socially. And so I urge readers to be hopeful, but not to put their object of hope in Wardy's neoliberalist vision.
Rorty talks about somehow, in your words, it somehow magically our shame doesn't further push us into fear, that somehow our shame turns into sympathy. How might Rorty envision that happening?
The most concrete thing he says is, he talks about 1 Corinthians 13. For your listeners that don't know, this is considered Paul's love passage. For Paul, there are three Christian virtues, faith, hope, and love. And then Paul concludes the greatest of these is love. Wardy really does want his vision of sympathy to be what he calls this Pauline love. And in Wardy's mind, He thinks that we can have a loving sympathy or a sympathetic love, whatever you want to put it, without what Paul means by faith and hope. So you have this kind of secularized version of Christian charity or Pauline love, whatever your readers want to call it. I think the Greek is agape. So agape is a kind of disinterested universal love. But that's what Wardy tells us he means by sympathy. So somehow we will, without the work of the Holy Spirit, which is what Paul thinks will happen in 1 Corinthians 13, right? Without that, we will all magically transform into having this kind of love, which again, Wardy also wants to call sympathy. The other thing is that Wardy thinks that we will rediscover as American citizens a kind of canon of novels that he seems to cherish in his own heart that teach us about the complexities of other people's lives. And so all the novels that he mentions are ones that sort of create this sympathetic readership in you as a reader to sympathize or to find yourself sort of feeling sorry for people who are not like you. And so he lists, I don't remember the titles offhand, but novels that have an immigrant who struggles. And so Americans who were once xenophobic will now sympathize with immigrants because of reading these novels. He does talk about how even secular people sort of have a faulty judgment about religious people. And so he does offer some novels that make religious people look more complicated. But for him, it's these novels where will form in us very much almost in an Aristotelian way, you know, where Aristotle thinks that we become virtuous by being around good people, virtuous people. Wardy thinks that we're going to become sympathetic by just being readers of these difficult and complex novels. Henry James is an author that he mentions throughout as someone that we will rediscover. So between the Apostle Paul and Henry James and other novelists, we will figure out ways to transform our shame into sympathy instead of fear.
Rorty makes an important distinction between empathy and sympathy. Why is that distinction so important for Rorty?
Yeah, that is important. And I take on another Rorty scholar that claims that Wardy actually does defend empathy. So this goes back to philosophy and mirror of nature, what we were talking about with his critique in that book, and it carries through his ethics. So the way I understand the difference between empathy and sympathy are that empathy is claiming that I can know what a person is going through as that person. So I can sort of get inside their head or get inside their heart, whatever metaphor you want to use. Whereas sympathy is, especially how the modern philosopher David Hume defines it, is simply being able, sort of out of my own place in life, to recognize that other people might have complexity and difficulty that makes it harder for them to either live a healthy life or live a moral life. But I'm able to recognize that other people have limitations on them, and that I'm able to, I guess the theological word here would be to offer a kind of grace to others by being sympathetic towards them, right? That they're struggling, and so I should withhold sort of any fear or judgment about what they're going through. And I think Wardy very clearly defends sympathy over empathy, because empathy makes that mistake that I called earlier representationalism. Right? Empathy assumes that we all each have something going on inside of our heads that we can have access to. And for Wardy, that's a philosophical mistake. In this sense, Wardy is more of a pragmatist, of course. And what I mean by that in this context is that it's not the things in our head that matter. It's sort of what we do with them. It's the consequences of our ideas or the consequences of whatever in our interior life that matters the most. It's not simply the assertion of an interior life. And so Wardy thinks asking for empathy or mandating empathy is a philosophical mistake, right? He may find it attractive morally, but he thinks that it's on faulty philosophical assumptions to think that we can be actually empathetic individuals, because that means that we each have sort of things in our head that others can access.
This question is going to get some grumbles from some people. Journalists and political theorists, a lot of them have this sense of believing that their work is going to bring about meaningful social change. Rorty seems to be suggesting that novels, as well as scripture, is going to be more effective at that. Why might that be the case?
Wardy's perspective, his attack is more on political scientists in this venue than journalists. He does think journalists are going to help. He just doesn't think that they're going to serve as much of a significant role as novelists are. And so for Wardy, he thinks that part of why we've ended up in this problem is that the discipline of political science has tried to be too objective. And the way that I take that is that it's turned itself into something that is data-driven and stats-based, rather than trying to form a educated, sympathetic citizenry. Right? And so if you go to an American political science department today, you're going to find probably, let's say a department of six, probably five data or stats experts, and then one person who does sort of the history of political science. Right? What Wardy feels like we've lost, and again, we can blame academic McCarthyism for some of this, is we've lost a notion that political science should be about helping citizens be informed, educated, even virtuous citizens. Wardy would never use the word virtuous, but that's basically what he's meaning here, right? So sympathetic would be the word he would use. And that political science departments should be doing this, right? And Wardy is not afraid of bucking the subjective-objective distinction in all areas of academia. And here's another case where he says, I don't care what it means to be objective, right? Objectivity in political science has ruined the discipline. It has made it completely unnecessary for what it means to form American citizens. And so instead of repairing that, right, instead of saying political science at some point are going to fix this, right, he just says we're going to move past it. So by 2045, I think he says something like literature and novels will replace all need for political science. It's some hyperbolic claim, but what he means by that is that it's really about subjective sympathy that is going to matter for turning things around. It's not about whether or not we can predict what Iowa's going to do in the next presidential election and go from there. So he's not as hard on journalists. He does think journalists do matter, but he does have a line in an essay in Philosophy and Social Hope that he does think novelists will play a more important role than journalists when it comes to getting out of the dark years.
Solidarity is an important theme for Rorty. And like a typical pragmatist, he expresses concerns about the benefits of abstract conceptions of solidarity. How does a local solidarity differ from a more universal or abstract sense of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish I could have spent more time on this in the book, actually. But the editor thought this was dry stuff. So I mean, here it's helpful to frame it as an internal philosophical debate, I think. I mean, this is the material that got cut from the book. So Wardy here is trying to separate himself from John Rawls, who he knew for a long time. They were collegial. They were friends. But for Rawls, what we're all looking for, what liberalism means, is this, what you suggest as a universal kind of abstract notion of justice, where Rawls's famous argument for the veil of ignorance is where justice begins, where we don't see who each other are. We have this kind of, like, Rawls actually argues for a type of blindness for liberalism and for justice to work within liberalism. And Wardy wanted to call himself a liberal, just like Rawls did, but really spent a major portion of his career, particularly in the 80s and 90s, trying to differentiate himself from Rawls's liberalism. And I think his use of solidarity is one of these situations in which he's trying to think about how could liberalism offer what you call a local solidarity? So instead of having these strides towards a universal abstract justice, what would it mean for solidarity to be something that we experience in American neighborhoods? You know, what, in terms of his predictions, what would it mean for solidarity to be defending someone who's about to get shot from a white suburbanite? Right? That's, for Wardy, that's what solidarity has to look like at the end of the day, is what are your actual actions that signify solidarity? And of course, this is the pragmatist turn, right? The pragmatist emphasis on actions and consequences. That very much what Wardy wanted to think about. I would say that part of Wardy's own problem that he left for himself was that he's very good about talking about the methodology of things like local solidarity, getting his readers to really think about our actual relationships and our practices in our neighborhoods, that he does not himself write on that very often. He does not give concrete examples of what that looks like. Other people that admire Wardy, like Cornel West and Jeffrey Stout, I think have done a much better job at filling that gap. So Wardy turns our attention away from an abstract universal notion of justice towards a local solidarity, but I still think there's work to do on what that actually looks like in real life. But I do think it's important to emphasize that Wardy's liberalism is not universal in scope, and Wardy part of his irritation of academic philosophy was its abstract nature. And in this sense, Rawls was, he was a good analytic philosopher because he brought political philosophy back almost single-handedly in the 1970s, but he still was too abstract from Morty's perspective. And at the end of the day, being too abstract just isn't helpful enough.
The bulk of your book is spent on outlining these predictions that Rorty makes, and then you use that to set up to then point out why it's so incredibly problematic for Rorty to be making political predictions. Why is that?
Yeah, that was my favorite chapter to write. So Rorty didn't shy away from naming his own enemies. Anyone that's read just a single essay of Rorty knows this. So two things that Rorty hates, that he tells us over and over he hates, are religious arguments, and he hates Enlightenment philosophy. Right? He calls it foundationalist, he calls it representationalist. Right? So here we're thinking of Immanuel Kant. Some read Hegel as an Enlightenment philosopher. Right? This notion that rationality is going to save us from sort of our human limitations. Okay, so we have this set of predictions that either look like religious prophecy, by which I mean Rorty is making predictions not just to predict the future, but also to judge the present, right? And that does seem like Rorty, in terms of the story I tell, that's what Rorty seems to be doing, is he's judging sort of academics in general, but also what he calls the new left in achieving our country, right? He's saying that they have failed, and that part of this failure is going to lead to the election of someone like Donald J. Trump, and it's going to lead to gun proliferation, and it's going to lead to another Great Depression. So very much that's the pattern of all the religious prophets in the Hebrew Bible, right? You make predictions about the future as a way to provide a judgment on the present. But we all know Rorty does not like religious arguments. And so I cannot imagine that he sees himself as making predictions for that purpose or within that pattern. So the other option within philosophy, or within historically speaking, is Enlightenment philosophy. So famously, Immanuel Kant in the essay, What is Enlightenment?, makes predictions about how eventually rationality will rule out for humanity. And he does this as a way to say that right now we are immature. That's Kant's word. We are intellectually immature, but we will become enlightened. We will become intellectually mature, and this will be universal in scope. And then Kant writes these two less famous essays about what sort of the future of politics looks like. Perpetual peace is a phrase Kant defends that will, through our rationality, will eventually have perpetual peace. So the problem with someone like Richard Rorty making predictions is that his predictions look a lot like either religious prophecy or Enlightenment philosophy, both of which he has spent a career mocking as schools of thought. And then to add to it, he has this really strange essay called Glorious Hopes, Failed Prophecies that was republished in Philosophy and Social Hope, saying that there's two texts that make predictions, the New Testament and the Communist Manifesto. These predictions have not come true. So the prediction of the New Testament is that Jesus will return, right? Paul thinks this is going to happen any day now. Still hasn't happened 2,000 years later. Marx and Engels make a prediction in the manifesto that the proletariat will rise up against the bourgeoisie. Capitalism will come to an end. Rorty says, we've lived through this 20th century. That's been tried, but it hasn't happened. Soviet communism did not let the proletariat rise above the bourgeoisie. Rorty's argument in that essay is that because of these failed predictions, everything in both texts are wrong. Everything in both texts are wrong. And so here we have Rorty himself making predictions. And the challenge for me was, as someone who's been asked to write on these predictions, since he's got some things wrong, does that mean that the whole Rortian corpus is wrong?
Oops. Right?
And so, of course, I conclude that no, that's silly. We shouldn't follow. And of course, he seems to not follow his own lead, because he comes back and says 1 Corinthians 13 is going to be one of the things that turn things around after the dark year. So he seems to change his mind on that. But so for me, the problem of Rorty himself making predictions is that it makes it hard to figure out where to fit him in the different styles of making predictions based on his earlier critiques of the manifesto, of the New Testament, of Enlightenment philosophy, and of the Hebrew prophets. So that's my answer about Rorty himself. And then I'll be more brief on this. I do think there's a temptation in the social sciences in general to offer predictions and to make it sound like we are making predictions with as much certainty as they do in the natural sciences. And I'm particularly thinking of like solar lunar eclipses, right? I mean, we've got it down to people can call it exactly when things like that are going to happen. And it seems like there's some people in the social sciences, and I would say more in political science than in philosophy, that seem to think that they can also make such predictions. And I think one of the big surprises of 2016 was that all these political scientists were acting like they were talking about a lunar eclipse. They were predicting Hillary Clinton to win as if they had as much certainty as a physicist has about a lunar eclipse. And then it didn't happen. And instead of owning up to their own sort of false sense of objectivity, they sort of, and from what I've read and from what I've experienced with colleagues, they're like digging in. They're saying, no, we can still make predictions with as much certainty. We just messed up this one time, right? And we messed up because they sort of blame the uneducated and the poor, right? We messed up because people like the uneducated and poor voted against their interests. How can we think about that? How can we consider that? And I think, oh my gosh, this opens up so many other problems, right? We don't listen to the poor and uneducated as academics. Anyway, but to answer your question about the problem of predictions, I think from a social science perspective, we have to be super careful not to sound like we have the same kind of certainty and precision that the natural sciences do when they're making predictions. And I think that there is a large portion of the social science scholars that tend to think and talk like that.
You also bring into question Rorty's sense of being a philosopher of hope. I believe he sees himself very much in that tradition, and you challenge that. He's also a very secular thinker, and for him, ultimately, in these predictions, his hope is in politics. You actually pull from a contemporary philosopher, Robert Talese, who recently published a book, Overdoing Democracy, and you offer this up as a way to say there are other less overtly political ways for us to bring about social change. What are some of these ways forward that may be a little less overtly political?
Yeah, and this connects to, I think that's a great question, and it also connects to another critique of Rorty I make, which is concerns friendships. I mean, Rorty, he gives us the categories of neighbors and strangers, never the category of friendships. And for me, this is part of a bigger problem that you mentioned, where as a secular thinker, and not all secular thinkers have to make this move, but in Rorty's version of it, it does seem like politics, particularly American politics, is his only object of hope. And I think the problem with that first is that that's always going to disappoint. I mean, I'm not cynical. I don't consider myself a cynic about politics, but I think it's a little irrational to think that politics are going to save the day eventually. I think they can make things better than we have now, but I don't think they're salvific in any way. But for me, when we talk about hope, I think hope has to connect more concretely to our everyday relationships and our ordinary life. And Rorty just seems to refuse to want to think about, even though he talks about local solidarity, he seems to want to refuse to acknowledge the importance of those kind of relationships. And so, yeah, I do think neighbors and strangers and having sympathy towards both of them are very important. I also think that having an acknowledgement of the friendships in our daily lives deserve probably to be the most direct object of our hope. And here I think secular and certain kinds of religious people can agree to that. And for me, it's sort of taking the next step from that Rorty offered. So if we start back to that Rawls-Rorty debate, right? Rawls is abstract, universal. Rorty is getting us closer to the ground. And then in this book, I saw myself as sort of taking the next step of really getting as much to the ground as we could to talk about our hope should be directed towards our everyday relationships and different aspects of our ordinary life. When it does come to putting hope in America and American politics, I'm not against that, but I argue for what is called a melancholic hope in this book. And what I mean by that is that if we're going to put any hope in American politics, that has to come with a kind of truthful recognition about the deep sins of racism and white supremacy in this country. And that you cannot put your hope in the object of American politics in the future if you aren't truthful about American politics in the past. And I think that's really important. So for me, you can have hope in American politics. There just has to be this much more concrete, serious process of dealing with and being truthful about and seeking justice for racial inequality in this country.
In writing this book, you mentioned how central your own children were in your mind as you're looking at this looming dark present and near future. For those who are wanting to either quickly move through these dark years that we might be in or to avoid them, what recommendations do you have in regards to actions that our listeners can take?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. I do want to pick up on the first part, though, because I do want your listeners to know that this book was an emotionally difficult book to write as a father. And my daughters have always been very engaged with my work. And so part of our dinner table ritual is talk about what we achieved that day. And when I was writing this book, I would talk about this book, and I would often go into tears about particular parts of what Wardy was predicting for all of our futures, but particularly their future. I mean, if he's right, they're the best years of their lives, right? From now until their 40s are going to be the worst parts of American history. And of course, no one deserves that, but I've always owned up to my own sort of subjective preference for my children. I really don't want them to deserve that. And so, yeah, I appreciate you asking that question and bringing that up. I think that what we can do is to piggyback on what I said a minute ago about melancholic hope. I mean, I do think being truthful about our past, it seems like that's still a controversial claim to make, right? That it seems like the right, and even some people on the left that sort of thought Obama meant a post-racial or post-racist country, they have not owned up to the brutal treatment of bodies, of African-American bodies in this country. And I'm not talking, it didn't end with slavery, right? That horrificness did not end with slavery. And I do think that as academics, we should call out every shooting that happens of a police officer towards a black man in this country. I think it needs to be known. It needs to be taught. I'm not going to tell my students sort of what to conclude from that, but they need the information, right? And we need to talk about the situations. A lot of our graduates at Southwestern go on to be police officers. I take that fact as that I'm obligated to teach about what it means to sort of read the situation and to be able to know that you always have other options than killing someone, right? And so, I mean, we laugh at it because we don't want to cry, right? I mean, it's such a horrendous thing that we have allowed our police officers to think that killing is the only option when they have so many weapons right on them and they have such large police forces. And so I think we have to be truthful. It's not just about the past, but about the present in terms of all of our inequalities. In this book, I really tried to raise up addressing racial inequality and economic inequality. But until we're truthful about our past and our present, I'm not sure there's any actions that can be taken for our future. I think once we are truthful, then I think some actions can be that we do invest more time in our everyday friendships, and that we do part of what it means to put our object of hope into our friendships means that when we invest more time into people, I do agree with Wardy that we should allow strangers to become neighbors. I would take the next step and say we should also allow neighbors to become friends. We should invest in the lives of people more. We should recognize that there are people who are hurting and lonely that no government policy can ever sort of respond to, right? That is a neighborly or friendly obligation to respond to that. So I think we should have universal health care. I think that's obvious at this point. I think people are hurting and dying because we don't have that. But I also think there's problems like loneliness and isolation that we can only solve by reaching out to people and by sort of making ourselves vulnerable in our everyday lives and investing in the lives of others. It's not the sexiest answer, but I think it's the sort of most hopeful and realistic answer.
Jacob, I appreciate you coming on the show, sharing some what I hope are some hopefully hope-filled answers amidst some very heavy themes. And hopefully we are not actually within the dark years. Nonetheless, I think there are reasons to hope. So again, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's been great to be here. Your questions were delightful, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.